Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
All right. Well, take a look around you. If you're at home or in the office, wherever you are, chances you're surrounded by a lot of stuff. Radio, computer, coffee mug, television, the chair you're sitting on, let alone your smartphone. Well, it all came from a factory. And especially if you're in the car, pretty much you're inside a complex machine made up of components from numerous factories around the world. I mean, in fact, everything we think of as essential to our modern lives exists thanks to factory production. And Joshua Freeman has written an exquisite history of factories around the world. He's a professor of history at Queen's College and Graduate Center of CUNY and author of the new book, Behemoth, A History of the Factory and the Making of the Modern World. And he joins us now. Professor Freeman, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks. It's a pleasure to be here.
So we've been plagued by a couple of technical difficulties throughout the show today, but I'm going to trust that that won't interfere with our conversation here. I just want to, first of all, ask you, this is an extraordinary history of factories through time, but I'm wondering what it is that made you want to take this on now, especially since it seems as if overall in the United States, we know that factory employment has been going down for some time.
Well, what caught my attention and got me going was the events in China, actually, in 2010, when a number of young people jumped off the roof of the factories owned by a company called Foxconn, which, frankly, I had never heard of, which assembles products for electronic companies. Particularly Apple made the iPhone and the iPad. And it said, buried in the story, is that there were 250,000 people that worked in these particular factory. So this was just a mind-boggling thing, which I really didn't know much about. But I started thinking, as a historian, you know, were there precedents for these landmark factories in the past that kind of defined the template for the future? And that's what this book turned out to be about. It's a series of case studies of the most advanced, the biggest, the most discussed factories, starting all the way back in the 1720s and ending up in modern China.
Yeah. Well, so let's start at the beginning there, because I think there, to me, one of the lessons I take away from your book is that the stories of factories and the transformative effect they have on societies is a story that we've been reliving over and over again through the centuries in different countries. So what was it like in the 18th century in the United Kingdom when those first massive, silk weaving factories came online?
Well, it was a new thing under the sun, and it was an extraordinary thing. The scale and the technology and the flow of products was something never seen before. These first factories, as you mentioned, made silk thread. Not that long after came the cotton factories, which were even larger and ultimately far more important. And people recognized right away something, you know, new and exciting was happening. People, you wouldn't connect with this. People like Daniel Defoe or James Boswell would be tourists. They would go look at these factories. And the early ones, which used water power, were in fairly rural, undeveloped areas. And then, boom, there's this, you know, five-story building, which, by the way, looks just like a lot of factories we have in Massachusetts and New York and other places, sitting there. So it was a kind of revolutionary jump and seen as such almost immediately.
Right. And then also the source of revolutionary wealth for the few men who owned and run the factory. It's interesting because the part where how you write about, you know, Defoe doing factory tourism, it runs completely in opposition to, say, the Dickensian view of factory life in the Industrial Revolution. I can't remember what book it's in, but he once described a factory as a some machines in a factory is a series of mad, melancholy elephants, you know, working in perpetuity.
I know exactly the passage you mean. It comes from his book, Hard Times.
Hard Times,
very
that's
critical.
Right.
Well, yes and no. I mean, it's a two-sided experience. You know, on one hand, it's this kind of magical Promethean triumph of mankind, these new machines, this new productivity. And yet, at least in England, it's also associated with child labor, with environmental despoilage. It's still in the 18th century when William Blake writes the poem that we now call Jerusalem, where he talks about the dark satanic mills. So when Dickens is writing in the 1840s, there are decades already of intense criticism of the factory, along with the praise for its kind of breakthrough.
Right. So this brings us then to the enormous importance of factories and manufacturing in Massachusetts. In the mid-19th century, because as you write it, and we've discussed on the show a number of times, that it's sort of a different form of factory life in the beginning, like capitalism at its gentlest, almost.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there had been factories before the textile mills in Waltham and Lowell, but they were pretty small scale. But Waltham and then, you know, particularly Lowell, Massachusetts, represent this kind of new model. It's large-scale manufacturing, and yet it seems to not have the ills of class conflict, of environmental spoilage, of impoverishment that were associated with manufacturing in Europe. And that's very important because a lot of Americans are very skeptical about manufacturing. They think it's going to undercut the new republic and its virtues, which are based on, you know, autonomous individuals, dispersed population, and so forth. Everyone loves Alexander Hamilton today, and he was a big advocate of the factory, but he was kind of a minority voice. Lowell seemed to suggest you could have the best of both worlds. Of course, as you say, For a while,
right. And, your book also pointed out something about Lowell that I never knew, that he brought the world the innovation of the stockholder corporation.
Well, he was the first to really use it for manufacturing.
Ah, got it.
There were corporations that were very unusual. Every single corporation had to have a special bill passed by the legislature. And they were generally only passed if there was some public utility, like a new canal or something like that. The idea to run a manufacturing business with this form of business was a big innovation. And it made possible a level of capitalization, which was unprecedented in the United States, because you could take the fortunes of multiple people and combine them into this one enterprise. And that's what made Lowell possible, because it cost a fortune to build the infrastructure and then the individual factories.
Right. I appreciate your clarification on the use of shareholder corporations for manufacturing, because it suddenly occurred to me that we've seen shareholder corporations even a couple of centuries before that. Apparently, the Puritans were helped funded by a bunch of shareholders who helped send them over here. So point taken on that. But here's what I want to ask you. The Massachusetts example is interesting for a bunch of reasons. One of them, which you were just discussing, that at least for a time, it seemed the exception to what is the general rule. It feels like the general rule of capitalism writ through factories, in that it ultimately requires or leads to the mass exploitation of workers. While on the one hand that has brought radical transformation to our societies, like you can't really imagine modern life without the things that these factories make, it's almost always inevitably come with this horrible human cost as well.
I think there's always a human cost. You know, how much and what type has varied in different moments. In Lowell, it was a temporary workforce. It was young women from the countryside who would come to the work in the factories for 4 or 5 years and then go on to their life, to get married, to settle elsewhere. And in part to attract those workers, because, you know, America had a labor shortage. It wasn't just out of goodwill that they went for that workforce, but where could you find hundreds and thousands of workers? So this was the underutilized group. To get them, you had to make an attractive place, a place that was morally safe with churches and boarding houses and supervision and conditions which are not too bad. When the conditions deteriorated by the 1830s, those young women, first they had a few strikes, and then they kind of just faded away because they had alternatives. And you ended up with a replacement immigrant workforce, first Irish, later French Canadian, other groups. And conditions were much, much worse. And they were there because they really had no choice.
Mm. See, so this is why factories occupy, I think, such a strange, bizarre, and fantastic place in sort of our collective consciousness, right? Because whether it's capitalistic societies or communist societies, or now we're seeing, of course, in rapidly developing countries, manufacturing is seen as the way to sort of supercharge the economy and lift a lot of people up at the same time. But I return to where you started in that there is this human cost. I mean, suicides at Foxconn, the exploitation of workers, the environmental cost that manufacturing has brought about. Why haven't we seemed to have learned that part of the lesson here, that we need to take care of people, too, as we try to grow the economy?
Well, you know, we've exported a lot of these factories, and in a sense, we've stopped looking. You know, it's out of sight, the factory. And even when we have a discourse in the United States, it's about returning factory jobs. But very few people actually talk about what goes on inside those places. We have a kind of nostalgia, and I think it's a nostalgia not for the actual work, but what that work could provide for people. And the unionized factory of the post-World War II era did make possible, you know, an upward mobility and a sense of security for so many Americans. So when someone like Donald Trump says, you know, make America great again, I think we have that image. But it's not an image that actually penetrates into the factory itself. And that's hard to see. And by the way, the people who run these big factories in Asia do their best to make sure you don't see inside them.
Right. So we have 30 seconds to go here, Professor. Last question. I mean, are you really writing a history that may soon come to an end because of automation, I wonder? Like, who's going to work in these factories in the future?
Well, I think the death is being proclaimed prematurely. Sure, automation is important, but we are pretty much near the historic all-time high on a global scale of manufacturing. Automation will certainly eliminate many jobs, but the factory age is nowhere near over.
Right. Well, Joshua Freeman's new book is Behemoth, A History of the Factory and the Making of the Modern World. Thank you so very much for joining us today.
Been my pleasure.
Well, that's it for today. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.